from North State Public Radio. I'm Ava Norgrove with your headlines for Monday, December 23rd. Pacific Gas and Electric got the green light on Thursday to increase customers' rates again. The California Public Utilities Commission approved two more rate increases to take effect next year. According to documents filed with the commission, the company requested the increases for the continued operation of Diablo Canyon Power Plant and for vegetation management. PG&E estimates the average customer will see rates go up by about $3.20 in January and by around $3.40 in March. Ilanka Slatire told commissioners at the meeting she wants more accountability for ratepayer dollars PG&E spends.
Why are we, the ratepayers, going to continue to subsidize a monopoly which continues to prioritize the profits of their shareholders above their responsibility to provide clean, affordable power to their ratepayers?
A spokesperson for PG&E told NSPR that rates fluctuate and pointed out that rates also decreased in July of this year. In other news, central to California's effort to dramatically reduce its reliance on fossil fuels is a ban on the sale of gas-powered vehicles by 2035. But is it possible to power all the new electric cars? NSPR's Ken Duvall takes a closer look.
Critics say there just aren't enough EV charging stations to power the electric vehicles needed to make the transition from dirty to clean energy. To address this disparity, the state is undertaking an aggressive effort to build out EV charging infrastructure to provide the power for those zero-emission cars. Earlier this month, the California Energy Commission approved $1.4 billion additional dollars to accelerate the installation of 17,000 new chargers. More than half of the funds will be spent in low-income and disadvantaged communities. Looking to the future, the number of public and private chargers is expected to reach 500,000 over the next few years. That's in addition to more than 500,000 home chargers. But will it be enough? According to DMV statistics, there are now more than 35 million registered vehicles on California roads. For NSPR News, I'm Ken DeBall.
Shasta County supervisors unanimously approved an agreement last week to equip sheriff's office deputies with body cameras. The $2 million agreement is with manufacturing company Axon Enterprises, which already supplies the sheriff's office with tasers. The sheriff says the cameras will allow for more accountability between police and the public, as well as more capturing of footage that can later be used for training. The Redding Police Department has had a body camera program in place for over a year. And finally, the shooter, who injured two children at Feather River Adventist School earlier this month, had an extensive criminal record, yet he was still able to obtain a handgun, which authorities have confirmed was a ghost gun. This type of firearm is bought piece by piece and then assembled. Alex McCourt is an assistant professor at the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions. NSPR's Ken Duvall spoke with McCourt to learn more about ghost guns.
So ghost guns are definitely a thorny issue, both for the prevention of gun violence and for policymakers trying to come up with solutions. And there is quite a fierce opposition to regulation of these. And some of that opposition comes in the form of kind of personal freedoms, you know, wanting to be able to make your own gun or have it be your hobby. And, you know, I think a really important element of this is that the regulations that are in place that have been passed in certain states mostly don't actually keep you from building a gun at home, but they put regulations on it, just like any other gun.
Why is it easy for someone, for example, in the case of this perpetrator, why is it so easy for someone like him to get a ghost gun?
So there are a few different problems that ghost guns pose. One problem is that they are untraceable. A traditionally manufactured gun has a serial number that allows law enforcement to trace where it came from and who purchased it. But these don't have that. Because they lack serial numbers and because they are sometimes not considered guns, they can be purchased without a background check. And so both of these features make them very appealing to people who might not be able to get guns in legal ways.
Now, I understand some jurisdictions, there is some requirement to serialize ghost gun components.
That's right. So there are 15 states that have some kind of law regulating ghost guns or they're sometimes called privately made firearms. And the Biden administration put forth a rule through the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives to try to regulate the sales of these kits. And this new rule said that these kits had to have serial numbers and you had to undergo background check if you were going to buy them. And so they tried to regulate them just like any other gun being sold.
When you're buying something online, how difficult is it for the seller to actually conduct a valid background check?
In most cases, you actually are not able to complete a purchase of a gun online. Usually you're going to have some kind of in-person interaction, whether it's to complete the background check or to get the gun or something like that. But if we're talking about kits that aren't guns, or if we're talking about code for a 3D printer, that can be delivered in very different ways and may be able to avoid the background check process altogether.
If you were advising a lawmaker about what you think should be done to control these, what would you tell them?
For ghost guns in general, or for privately manufactured firearms, one of the most important things is to just bring regulation of these guns in line with all other guns. And then I think we really need to be talking about, you know, seller and manufacturer kind of supply side regulations. But that is certainly a problem in which, you know, the technology is advancing much more quickly than the law is. When we do kind of nationally representative surveys where we look at gun owners and Democrats and Republicans and non-gun owners, we find pretty consistent support for a lot of gun policies like requiring background checks for certain purchases, policies like extreme risk protection orders, policies like those that encourage or require safe storage.
Are there any statistics about how prevalent ghost guns are?
What we do know is that the number of them recovered by law enforcement has increased dramatically. Really, over the last 5 or 6 years, there's been a huge increase in recovery of these guns. The ATF in particular, when it put out its proposed rule, they said that what they recovered in 2020 and 2021 was nearly twice as many as they recovered between 2016 and 2019, all combined. But we don't really have good data on how they're being used or how they compare to other guns. And part of this is because we don't have really good data about gun transactions and gun tracing in general. And part of it is because by design, these guns are not intended to be traced. And so it's often difficult to really get a good grasp on where they're coming from, how they're being used, and how many are being recovered.
That was Alex McCourt, an assistant professor at the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions, speaking with NSPR's Ken Duvall. You can read more about ghost gun regulations at mynspr.org. And those are your headlines for Monday, December 23rd. Our theme song is Burrow and courtesy of Blue Dot Sessions. For more local and state news, head to our website, mynspr.org. For NSPR News, I'm Ava Nora Grove.